this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, this for this next hour, they're going to be the views of Tom Reed, who, of course, is the president of the American Christian Network up there in Washington, where we do our regular evening programs, and Tom is going to be talking to us about really what's going on as far as certain suggestions that have been made by the Federal Communications Administration that would suggest that there would be some sort of a community board that would actually sort of make recommendations as far as the direction the radio stations were going. But how do you get a community board to come in and say something about private radio stations? I mean, private radio stations are privately owned, and certainly we think that the owners of the stations know what's best for the station. So without further ado, Tom, why don't you bring us up to date? What's this all about, and why should people really be concerned about what's happening in radio?
Well, Dr. Stan, thank you very much. What an honor to be on your national program. We all listen to you each night up here in the Great Northwest, and it's certainly an honor to be with you tonight. This is a very important matter that affects every one of our listeners, because what we're really talking about is the federal government getting into dictating what you have a right to hear on your local radio and television station. That's really the bottom line. And I think, Dr. Stan, everyone realizes that a free society cannot long remain free without a free press, and that's radio and television. And that, I think, what is being threatened right now. Specifically, the Federal Communications Commission has issued a notice of proposed rulemaking. Now, that's not unusual. That's part of the Administrative Procedures Act. That's what's required of the FCC. They have to issue a notice saying, this is what we propose to do. And then they have to allow a comment period for the general public to make comments and then reply comments. What concerns me about the gravity of this particular notice is that in the language, and by the way, there are some 200 pages in this report and notice, and I will later mention where, if anyone wants to read them all, they can go to the Internet and can print them out. But really, it is a situation where the Federal Communications Commission, to a large extent, makes up their mind, pretty much has an idea that they have enough votes. They're five members of the FCC. If three vote to implement these proposals, then they have the force of law. Now, before we get into some of the specifics, Dr. Stan, I want to make sure everyone understands we're not talking directly about the fairness doctrine, which I know you've discussed on your program before with guests. However, I do think this is a backdoor way of basically coming around to some of the same concepts of the fairness doctrine. The fairness doctrine presently is in Congress, and it's dead on arrival, because President Bush has said he will not sign any sort of a fairness doctrine bill. So that's not what we're talking about. We're also not talking about pornography, that type of thing. I think we all agree that we don't want pornography or bad language on radio and television, and there are already federal laws which handle that situation. So that's not what we're talking about. What we are talking about is a notice of proposed rulemaking, which is going to be specifically difficult on the smaller independent radio stations, the type of radio stations that carry what I refer to as some of the alternative programming.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. All right, Tom, go right ahead.
The alternative radio programming that I'm referring to, Dr. Stan, is like your program, like Larry Bates' News and Views program, like some of the other programs, Focus on the Family, for instance. And let me make this point. When I first started reading these 200 pages of this notice, I had a very open mind. Because for many years, I was on the FCC Industry Advisory Committee on Radio Broadcasting. I was also on the NAB Board of Directors. And I felt during the Reagan years, the FCC basically used common sense. And what they proposed generally made sense. But after I read the 200 pages, I thought, wait a minute. They talk about what they perceive as the problems, and then the solutions really don't solve the problem. So it doesn't make sense. It's like a very bad medical diagnosis, Dr. Stan. So I read the 200 pages again. And then I called some friends back in Washington that are much more knowledgeable on the FCC and these type of things than I am. And I said, you know, here's the conclusion I've come to. It doesn't make sense. So there must be some covert reasons why the commission is doing this.
And that, of course, is the thing I think that we learn after a certain period of time. If something doesn't make sense, there has to be another explanation. So what is the explanation?
Well, there are many of us, Dr. Stan, that believe the covert or the other explanation is that there is a frustration by members of Congress, by some of the members of the FCC, with the Telecom Act of 96. Now, basically, that was the act that totally changed our policy with respect to radio and, to a lesser extent, television ownership in the United States. It basically allowed monopolies. It allowed, rather than owning a maximum of 21 stations, AM, FM, and TV nationally, you could own any number. And Clear Channel at one time owned over 1,000. Citadel owns hundreds. CBS, Viacom, I don't know how many they own. But we really ended up with about 5 major monopolies. And in any given community, I don't care the size of the community, the rules of the Telecom Act allowed 3 major monopolies to own basically all of the good radio facilities. Now, a lot of people have said, you know, that didn't work out the way we thought it would.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll bring our stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Tom Reed, who is certainly the president and general manager of the American Christian Network up in eastern Washington, is saying that, you know, there are people who are very unhappy with an act that was passed back in 1996, which, of course, removed the restrictions on the number of stations that any one organization could own. And now there are certainly a few organizations that own literally thousands of radio stations. In fact, what has happened is today 5 mega corporations dominate the radio industry and own a large percent of the media outlets. This would be not only, of course, radio, but television and certainly print and newspapers and magazines. But 5 mega corporations dominate the field of communication, and as a result, are largely able to influence what the American people read, what they hear, what they see, and ultimately what they believe. So pick the story up there, Tom.
Well, what's happened is that through this frustration, particularly the Democratic members, the 2 quite liberal Democratic members of the FCC, have been going around the country and holding informal hearings. And, of course, every liberal organization you can name came out and testified at these hearings. Now, I think some of the complaints were valid, because I frankly think the Telecom Act, in lifting the ceiling on the number of radio stations you could own nationally and locally, was a mistake. I agree. But the proposals the commission now has before it are not going to solve the problem. They're dancing around the edges, and in doing so, they're going to cause great harm to the type of independently owned local stations that carry the alternative media type programs like yours, like Larry Bates, like Jim Dobson. And you might wonder, well, why is that a problem? Why would people in Washington, D.C. or the FCC be concerned about the alternative media? Let me make an example. I had a friend quite some years ago, probably 20 years ago or so, that was studying some legislation that came out. I think it, frankly, was in the medical area, doctor. And he was very concerned. He thought this was a very bad bill, and about all he could do was write a few letters to the editor, leave a few messages with his congressmen and senators, but he really couldn't get any national emphasis going on information about what he felt was bad in this bill. Now, contrast that today, Dr. Stan. You have Bob Chapman, for instance, on your program, and everybody loves the information he brings, and many other people that you don't hear on the nightly news on CBS or NBC or ABC. You don't hear on the Hannity and Combs or the Rush Limbaugh programs, only on what I term this alternative media. Now, today, when there is something going on in Washington and we have someone that does some investigative work, they can literally overnight, by going on your show, by going on Larry Bates' show, by going on Focus on the Family with Jim Dobson and so forth, you can generate literally thousands of phone calls, emails, faxes to congressional offices the next morning. That's the power today of this, what I call the alternative media. Now, you say, well, but this is, you know, free enterprise. Doesn't government like to hear from people? Not really. And this isn't a Republican or a Democratic situation. There are a lot of things done in Washington, and you listeners to Radio Liberty know this, that the politicians would just as soon we didn't know about. You know, there are sections of bills which oftentimes congressmen and senators don't even know are in bills that they vote on, because unfortunately they often don't read the bills before they vote on them. And it's very embarrassing when they start getting hundreds of calls on a Tuesday morning saying, what's the position of my congressman on Section 506C of such and such House bill? And they say, well, where did you hear about that? Well, I heard a guest on Dr. Stan's program last night. They don't like that type of interrogation by the general public. And I've talked to some people in Congress, and they say, yeah, I mean, it's the American way, but we would just as soon go away. Well, the problem with these proposals by the FCC is that the proposals are going to be the hardest on the type of stations, the local independent stations, that carry this type of programming. So I think we have two swords coming at us. The number one is that if these proposals become law passed by the FCC, and remember, this doesn't have to go through Congress. All you have to have is 3 out of 5 votes by a bureaucratic administrative agency. Now, Congress can step in, and I hope they do, and we'll talk about that later because I have some specific suggestions that I hope all of you will take action on. But the problem is that this is getting the government into the direct control of what you can hear on radio and television.
Well, now, how is it going to go about doing that, Tom?
Okay, number one, there are 3 major sections and then just some ridiculous aspects of this notice of proposed rulemaking. The first one is the establishment, the requirement to establish a local advisory committee. In fact, they call it under Section 73, community advisory boards. Now, in the notice, they say that the purpose is so that the radio station owners and managers know what's going on in their local community.
But I guess who determines who will be on that board would be the question.
That is a very big question, and that's one of the questions that's not answered. But they do make a point, and let me quote. They say, under Section 69, the principle of localism, whatever that means, requires broadcasters to take into account all, and that's in italics, all significant groups within the communities when developing balanced community-responsive programming, including those groups with specialized needs and interests.
Well, I mean, you would be talking about hundreds of groups in any community, certainly a very large community. I mean, you'd be talking about people from the right, from the left. You'd be talking about blind people, deaf people. You'd be talking about people with learning handicaps. I mean, how could you possibly establish any sort of a committee with all these people in it, the people who are worried about education, the people who are worried about finance, certainly people, organizations like the ACLU and certainly the organizations that really believe we have too much religious broadcasting, or too much, and that groups believe we don't have enough religious broadcasting. How could you come up with an advisory committee with that many and get anything at all accomplished?
Well, and one of the things, Dr. Stan, and you're absolutely right, that they point out in this notice is that the committee must be culturally diverse. Now, let's take some examples, because I don't really have a problem with board of advisors, but the problem is, as you read on in the 200 pages, the FCC is hinting at a certain amount of power and authority of these community advisory boards at license renewal time. Now, let's take an example. You're somewhat near the San Francisco area. I think all of our listeners know that San Francisco is a very pro-homosexual city. Now, you would have a difficult time if you owned a radio station in San Francisco under the guidelines of the FCC, what they're proposing, not to have some homosexual activists on your community advisory boards. Now, they could say, well, you don't have any programs on your station. You're, we'll say, a religious station or a classical music station. You don't have any programs advocating what we're advocating, same-sex marriage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when the license renewal time comes along, if you have not been responsive to these suggestions from members of the Community Advisory Board, there's a hint that the FCC will take that into consideration and that you will have to explain yourself, which means you start paying lawyers. And if your license is held up and not immediately renewed, what sort of financing are you ever going to be able to get to maintain and improve your radio station? Financing will dry up unless there is a reasonable expectation of renewals. But can you imagine all of these members from various cultural segments, and particularly the FCC underlines underserved, whatever that means. I mean, certainly the homosexual community could say, well, we're underserved. Certainly the pro-abortion community in San Francisco, using my example, could say, well, we're underserved in your programming. And they file complaints at license renewal time. The effect will be that local stations, these independent stations that have been carrying your program, as I say, Larry Bates' program, Jim Dobson's program, and many others, I just use these as examples, will all of a sudden say, we're just going to have motherhood, apple pie, and pablum. We're not going to air any programs that get into the discussion of controversial public issues. That's, I think, going to be one of the effects, plus a tremendous amount of harassment, if this local advisory boards becomes law.
Well, I certainly can see why you would be very concerned, because the trouble is that the people on the left think that the media is controlled by the people on the right. The people on the right can believe the media is controlled by the people on the left, and But apparently there's some very powerful people out there who would like to silence everything in radio. We'll be right back. Well, our guests this evening, Tom Reed, and of course, from my point of view, I believe talk radio is the last vehicle we have for being able to reach the public with the truth. Certainly, it's too expensive to buy time on television. It's too expensive to buy newspapers and magazines, and certainly you're totally dependent upon advertising there. But talk radio is really a fascinating vehicle of bringing ideas out, and more Americans are beginning to learn what's going on. It looks to me like, in many respects, this is really an attack on the alternative medium that is growing in its influence across the nation. Would you feel that that was a fair appraisal?
I think so, absolutely. I think that there's no question that it is attack. The big stations, the Clear Channels, the Citadels, the CBS, you know, they have enough money, they have enough lawyers. I'm not so concerned for them. And frankly, I'm not so concerned for the stations. I'm concerned for the listening public and their rights. Well, let's take a look at the second major aspect of this notice of proposed rulemaking. Because we have a responsibility to notify our communities of hazards, so to speak, be it inclement weather that may cause a problem, maybe a train in our community tips over and there's some fumes that would be very injurious to the public, whatever sort of local emergency or even national emergency, we all recognize as radio station owners we have a responsibility and we have a very good national system, the emergency alerting system, that allows the President of the United States to literally press a button and he will be heard live on every radio station that's on the air and cable systems also. Same thing with your governor and the same thing with your local, I think generally out of your local sheriff's office. So we already have emergency alerting already automatic and already set up, and I think it works basically very well. But the commission, on the one hand, is saying, well, that's not enough. So we want to go back and require that all radio stations have an operator on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, what sort of sense does that make? Because what are you saying that, let's say in a smaller town you have five radio stations on the air overnight, and so if there was a local emergency, your emergency preparedness people would have to say, okay, now where's my list of inside numbers at the local radio stations? And they would start dialing the local stations and saying, this is Sheriff such and such or Chief of Police, and we've got a problem and we want you to put this message on the air. Well, the first thing that would happen is you'd have to call back and have some sort of authority that this is a real emergency and it was really the sheriff calling. So you would have to have some sort of probably password and a special phone number where you would call back. This would probably take a half hour to 45 minutes to get the message on the air. Simply because you have somebody sitting at your radio control studio 24 hours, 7 days a week to presumably increase the notice of emergencies to the public.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Tom. We're going to bring our stations right on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Tom Reed is saying that the second portion of the of this plan, this for this new program, the Federal Communication is talking about putting out, deals with, of course, the fact that the stations, radio stations, have an obligation to notify the community if there's a hazard, there's an emergency alert system by which the President of the United States can press a button and literally be heard on almost every station in the United States. But in an effort somehow to complicate this issue, why they're going to demand that every station have an operator on the board 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, financially, a lot of radio stations simply cannot afford to do that. We have a small radio station of our own. We have no operator there. It's all done by a computer. And the only programming we do is the program that we do here in our evening that is replayed again the following afternoon. But we cannot afford an operator. We're a non-profit organization, not by choice, but by reality. But of course, we have a number of stations, and they're computerized. You can have one central operator. He can control half a dozen stations or a dozen stations from one central authority. But what they're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, is that it's going to have to be an operator at every station 24/7.
That's basically what part of this notice of proposed rulemaking says.
How could you possibly afford to do that?
You can't. And see, here's going to be the end result, and this is why I'm concerned about the public's right. I'll tell you exactly what's going to happen, and I've talked to some radio station owners, and they said, we're going to start signing off at 10 p.m., because if you're a full-time station, you only have to be on two-thirds of the time that you're licensed to be on. So if you're licensed to be on 24 hours a day, it comes out to 10 p.m. at night. Now, that means programs like Bill Bennett's, which is live on the West Coast from 3 to 6 a.m., it won't be on the air. I don't know of any radio stations. Oh, there may be some, of course, with local sports or something. But by and large, as a generality, Dr. Stan, local radio stations have no income after about 7 o'clock at night until 6 a.m. the next morning, and definitely not after 10 o'clock at night until 7 a.m. the next morning. And so there's no income to offset the hiring of some high school kid at minimum wage just to sit and talk to his girlfriend on the phone from the local radio station. It makes absolutely no sense. And that's why we think there's covert thinking involved here. Now, the third aspect, I think, may also affect you. I'm not sure where your radio station license is, the official city of license, but the commission seems to think that maybe we should move the main studios for all stations to the official city of license within the city limits of the city of license. Now, let me give you an example. Our affiliate in Tri-Cities, Washington, is officially licensed to the city of Pasco. Now, Pasco, Richland, and Kennewick are three cities called the Tri-Cities, Tri-Cities, Washington. And, in fact, the Tri-Cities has its own postal zip code, has its own post office, I believe. Now, I never know when I'm driving in Pasco or whether I'm in Kennewick or whether I'm in Richland. I mean, they're that close together. There's a river that goes through, and I guess when you cross the river, you're in another town. But you don't even think of that. You think of it as the Tri-Cities. Now, our official studio is in Kennewick because from Pasco, there's a hill in the way, and it's an FM station, and we can't microwave line of sight to our transmitter up on a nearby mountain. And that's the determination we generally use for locating a main studio. Now, the rules presently, and for a long time, have stated that the studio can be within 25 miles of the city of license, or can be located anywhere within the basic community coverage. That's a contour on a map that's done based on technical power levels. And you can have your studio anywhere within that basic coverage area, which I think makes a great deal of sense. But to have to move a studio, and again, the big boys can afford to do anything, but the smaller independent stations, I'm coming back to that point again and again, they would be very hard hit. It would cost thousands and thousands of dollars to uproot and move a studio a few miles simply to be within the legal city of limits of your city of license. And for what reason? Well, presumably because you are closer to the people in the community and as a convenience to the people in your community.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Tom is just saying that another one of the requirements, or another one of the suggestions in this, a new FCC regulation would require that the studio had to be in a city of license, and yet, of course, many times, by the city, the studio may be outside the city of license, but that doesn't mean, of course, that they, are not serving the community just equally as well. But go ahead and pick up the story there.
Well, the thing that doesn't make sense about this aspect is that the FCC seems to be thinking in terms of the 1950s or 40s. People do not come to local radio station studios anymore. As a very young kid, Dr. Stan, I used to get a kick out of going downtown Tacoma, and I would go into KMO. And in those days, stations had big foyers with overstuffed chairs, and they had these huge plate glass windows that looked into a big Studio A. And these Studio A's, as we called them, were large enough to hold an orchestra. And every night at 5 o'clock in Tacoma on KMO, Cherokee Jack and his rhythm-riding Wranglers did a live half-hour show. And as a little kid, I used to, particularly when my mom was downtown shopping, she would park me at KMO, and I would just sit and watch things going on in their big studio. Well, I've got to tell you, in 2008, radio stations don't have live Studio A's anymore. The way that the general public contacts their local radio station today is via email. In fact, it's about, my guess, and it might vary from city to city, station to station, but probably 95 to 98% of the contact is by email, and maybe 2 to 5% by the phone, fax, zero. So what logic does it make to improve what by causing stations to spend thousands and thousands of dollars uprooting their studios and moving a few miles? Again, it doesn't make sense. Now, let me read, if I may, Dr. Stan, a letter as we sort of move into the what should we be doing about this. Because, again, I really think this is a backdoor effort to somewhat accomplish what the Congress was not able to do, at least presently, with the reinstatement of the Fairness Doctrine.
All right, before you read that letter, however, please wait just a moment. We'll bring our... And there we are. Of course, our guest this evening, Tom Reed from the American Christian Network, and he's going to be reading a letter. First of all, we've been talking about the absurdity of one of the rules that they're trying to bring in, and that is, of course, that the studio has to be in the city of notice, where your license for SoCal, you have to have your studio in SoCal. I could not have it just down the street, about 3/4 mile in Capitola. No, it has to be in SoCal. Well, be that as it may, we're going to go ahead and read, Tom, why don't you go ahead and read this letter that you wanted to bring out, which shows, I hope, the absurdity of what this is all about.
Well, this is a letter, Dr. Stan, that a number of members of Congress have sent to the chairman, Chairman Martin, of the Federal Communications Commission. And I would like to urge all of our listeners to contact their local House member and their members of the Senate and say, have you signed on to the letter to the FCC chairman? And by the way, the docket number is 04-233. Now, here's the letter, and it really, I think, states the situation very well. Dear Chairman Martin, now remember, this is members of Congress writing to the chairman of an administrative agency, a bureaucrat. We are writing you today because we are dismayed to hear that the Federal Communications Commission is considering a radical re-regulation of our nation's broadcast system in the pending localism proceeding. It's our understanding that the Commission is set to turn back the clock on decades of deregulatory progress by imposing a series of new and burdensome regulations on broadcasters. We urge you to reconsider these actions. While we agree with the Commission that fostering more and better local programming is a laudable goal, we do not agree that mandates from Washington are the best means of achieving that goal. Indeed, the tentative conclusion in the localism proceeding to effectively force broadcasters to air programming that fits preordained categories creates clear constitutional concerns. In addition, mandating how broadcasters interact with their communities, such by forcing licensees to form permanent advisory boards, would require layers of bureaucracy that weigh down the marketplace and unfairly burden broadcasters, while leaving other media, cable, satellite, and internet, free to compete without comparable government interference. We also must focus on a pair of proposed re-regulations that could cost the broadcasting industry millions of dollars in unnecessary costs. According to the recently released report on broadcast localism, the Commission is considering the reinstatement of two particularly archaic policies that had long been abandoned: the rule that required broadcasters to maintain their main studio only within the community of license, and the rules regarding unattended technical operation of broadcast facilities. The first rule, also known as the main studio rule, was relaxed in 1987 when the Commission decided that forcing broadcasters to maintain their main transmitting studio within and only within the community of license was overly restrictive and unnecessary. The rule was further relaxed in 1998 to level the playing field between large and small broadcasters and to allow broadcasters with multiple licenses in an area to co-locate main studios and combine resources, significantly reducing administrative costs. This rule change, which allows stations to now place their main studios within their primary listening area, was consistent with the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and gave licensees much-needed flexibility. Reverting back to out-of-date rules would impose significant costs on broadcast licensees that have made good faith investments based on the rule changes, costs that will harm broadcasters' ability to serve the public interest. Further, the stated goal of the re-regulation, namely to encourage broadcasters to produce locally originated programming, requires a logical leap that has no place in government regulation and is a thinly guised method of controlling broadcast content. The second rule change under consideration would require broadcasters to maintain a physical presence at every broadcasting facility during all hours of operation. The old rule requiring broadcasters to keep a licensed radio operator at the transmitter's site at all hours was abandoned in 1995 after the Commission deemed it superfluous and archaic in light of modern technology. Technology hasn't reverted, so why go back? If there is a concern about emergencies, then it seems that focusing on reforming emergency training and education would be a more rational approach than penalizing every local broadcaster in the country with unnecessary labor costs. We appreciate your attempts to improve local media, but we disagree with your proposed methods. Any approach to regulate media that violates constitutional principles or unnecessarily burdens the industry when other less burdensome methods are available should be discarded. And I know that that was signed by Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers from the state of Washington, and Bill Sally from the state of Idaho, and by other members of the House of Representatives, but I don't know how many.
Well, now, of course, first of all, is that letter available somewhere on the Internet? Do you have a website people could go to?
Dr. Stan, since it was given to me by a chief of staff of a congressperson, and they did not tell me it was confidential, I don't see why I can't put this letter on our ACN website.
Now, right now, how can people then get to the ACN website? Because I think the letter is very, very clear. I think it certainly clarifies what the issues are, and I don't know who wrote it, but whoever wrote it certainly has a grasp of what the problem is. And
absolutely.
It's my feeling that there's no problem facing America today, whether it be in medicine, whether it be in finance, whether it be in radio and communication. There's no problem facing America today that a new government's rules and regulations won't make worse. And we've seen this time and time again. The more government interferes, the more problems we have. And so anyway, how can people get to your website and get copies of this letter?
Dr. Stan, give me another day, and
right.
I'll have it up. The website is www.ACN, stands for American Christian Network, ACN.cc, not com. It's ACN.cc. Now, I would also urge that you go to another website, and this you can go to tonight as soon as we're off the air at 9 o'clock. It's www.savechristianradio.com. Now, this webpage was actually produced by a law firm that practices before the FCC in Washington, D.C., and they pretty much spell out the same problems that you and I have been talking about tonight, Dr. Stan. And I should point out for those listeners who may not be Christians, that may not listen to Bible teaching on the radio or Christian music on the radio, this is not just an issue with Christian stations. This is an issue with every single local radio station, and your right to hear what you want on your local station, not what is mandated by the federal government. Now, some of the other aspects, I mentioned that the three major parts of this notice were the local committees, the changing of studios to the city limits of the city of license, and the 24/7 operators. Now, there's some other things that the commission talks about in these 200 pages, which really sort of show where they're coming from. One of the things they call national playlists. Now, we don't play music, Dr. Stan, but as a kid, when I first started as an announcer, why, I used to play records all the time. Well, the commission is actually raising the question that maybe local radio stations should be required to play a certain amount of local artists. I mean, you talk about an intrusion into local programming. I mean, to me, that's ridiculous. I mean, let's take a... I know in San Francisco they have a station that plays what we call the standards, Frank Sinatra and Doris Day and all of the great 50s and 60s
All the oldies, we call them, the oldies.
You know, Frankie Randall, Jack Jones, Jerry Vale, et cetera, et cetera. Well, can you imagine me, who can't sing a note, who has reoccurring laryngitis, cutting on a cassette tape and going into a radio station in San Francisco and saying, hey, you play Jerry Vale and all these records, and I live here in San Francisco, and you're a local station, and the FCC says you have to air a specific amount of time to local talent. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, this almost gets into the absurd, but I am not making this stuff up. It's on page 47. Now, another thing that the commission is getting their head involved in, they call voice tracking. Now, what this really boils down to, and the complaints they got were, that local announcers, yes, some local announcers have been displaced. And I'm not picky on Clear Channel, I just use them as an example because most people know that Clear Channel is the largest radio station owner in the country. Clear Channel had, at one time, over 1,000 stations. They voluntarily sold off around 400 and some, so they're down to about 800 and some. In their station in Boise, Idaho, for instance, you could hear an announcer, really great announcer, you thought, gee, does this guy really live in Boise? Well, no, he didn't. He probably worked at Clear Channel station in New York or San Francisco or L.A. or Dallas. And yes, when Clear Channel ended up with 7 or 8 stations, and they had the ability to use talent from 800 stations nationwide, they didn't need a full staff of announcers at all local 8 stations, we'll say, in Boise, Idaho, as just an example. And so, yes, some announcers were let go, or they were pushed into sales, or given an opportunity to go into the technical end of the operation, or whatever, but they weren't on the air anymore. Well, these are the type of people that have been complaining to the FCC at these hearings they held around the country, saying that the FCC should do something about national playlists. And they say, quote, "We discussed the possible adverse effect on localism of national music playlists developed by large corporate radio licensees on the access of local talent to airtime." Well, you talk about an intrusion into the federal government dictating what your local radio station does. I mean, that says it all, Dr. Stan.
It certainly does. And, of course, the thing is that what are you going to do when you've got somebody like Rush Limbaugh on 600 stations? Are you going to have a separate announcer at every radio station coming in at certain periods of time? I mean, the one reason, of course, that programs like that are successful is because they only have to have one staff for all 600 stations. And then the local stations, of course, will, cut in from time to time, but usually probably with a computer, and they will simply go ahead and play their local advertisements. But certainly you cannot let the federal government come in and begin to dictate this, or it would become prohibitively expensive, and especially now as we see our whole economy contracting, we see more and more businesses getting into real trouble. I really anticipate there's going to be problems even with radio and advertising. We could really bring many of our radio stations to the brink of bankruptcy by forcing them to have local announcers. I mean, certainly, if you want to have a local announcer, that's fine. But if you don't want to have a local announcer, why should you have to have one?
You know, this whole program, this whole report, the whole background of this is shrouded in motherhood and apple pie, and it's called localism. As if there is some magic to a program that originates within your studio or within your local community. And you know, Dr. Stan, you just hit on something. We're talking and thinking properly so, I believe, about covert reasons for this. People like Rush Limbaugh are on, I don't know how many, I'm going to guess 200 to 400 stations across the country. Enough stations that he can be heard literally in every market, small and large, in the United States. Now, there are probably people that don't like the fact that a Rush Limbaugh can be heard literally nationwide via radio networks. And maybe part of this thinking, if the FCC can get away with dictating such things as voice tracking, national playlists, local committees, percentage of local programs that you air, stations would have to stop airing some of these national programs. I mean, just thinking out loud, but I'm wondering if really that's part of the thinking. And the ridiculous example I have used, and again, can you imagine when your parents and grandparents used to listen to Jack Benny in your local hometown? Jack Benny was on the CBS radio network. He was a fabulous comedian. Can you imagine the government saying, well, no, station in Twin Falls, Idaho, you can't carry that much network programming. You can't carry the Jack Benny radio show. You have to get some local comedian. I mean, come on.
Well, I really think, of course, what we need to do is get government out of this. What you're really talking about is central planning. Centralized planning doesn't work. It didn't work in the Soviet Union, and it's not going to work here in the United States. It was a centralized planning that led to the fall of Russia, because economically, the system didn't work. And whenever you get a group of bureaucrats together, or whenever you try to rule by consensus, why, of course, the people of the local community lose out. So I share your concern. How can people really do something? Do you want them to write their congressman? Would you suggest that they get in touch with these people at SaveChristianRadio.com? What can people actually do at this point if they are as concerned as you are and I am?
Dr. Stan, I think that Congress is going to have to raise their voice. Now, Congress controls the dollars. They control oversight of the FCC, properly so. And I think if enough people in Congress sign this letter to the chairman, if congressional offices get phone calls, emails, telegrams, faxes, whatever, saying, we do not want the federal government dictating what programming we can hear on our local stations, Congress people will act. And if the FCC realizes that Congress might preempt them, I mean, bureaucrats don't like to be preempted by Congress.
Hold on, we'll be right back. Okay, go right ahead. Well, now, of course, would you want the people to, but if they would call their congressman, what would they say? Is there legislation? What specifically would they say? We don't want to go along with this 04-233-233. What would it be they would say?
Yes, I would say that we do not want the FCC to pass the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, Docket 04-233, on localism. Localism is the buzzword that the FCC is using. And if they say, well, gee, we don't know what they're talking about, then suggest that they call Kathy McMorris Rogers' office, and they all know who the congresspeople are, who their fellow members are. She's from the state of Washington, and I have briefed her chief of staff. In fact, after I briefed in about an hour phone call the chief of staff of Kathy's, they drafted this letter. I don't know who drafted it, but I agree with you. It was extremely well done. I think that Congress has to let its voice be heard at the FCC, and maybe if the FCC moves forward on this, and we won't know for another month or two, then we have to say to Congress, you're going to have to introduce some legislation that says specifically this cannot be done by the FCC. And I think that if the FCC right now hears enough from members of Congress, they may take a second look at this and they say, uh-oh, we've gone too far. Because remember, Dr. Stan, if they came out blatantly and said, we are passing a rulemaking that says every radio station must carry X number of hours of programming, which will be sent to them from Washington, D.C., produced by an agency of the federal government, there would be such an uprising that it would never happen. But you see, they're sort of getting the same end result by just putting a little heat on the frog at a time. And that's what concerns me.
And I certainly agree with you. And, of course, that's 04-233. And it is, of course, the FCC program on localism. It's a wonderful word, but what does it mean? What it really means is that they're going to, from Washington, D.C., they're going to begin to control what's done locally.
Well, now, Dr. Stan, if I may interject, I think also, to answer your question, they should write fax the FCC, and if they will go to this website...
Hold that thought, we'll be right back.
Certainly.
All right, fine. Well, Tom was simply suggesting that people call their congressmen and ask them if they don't know what this issue is. This directive from the FCC 04-233 on localism, that they call Kathy...
McMorris-Rogers.
Rogers, okay. Kathy McMorris-Rogers, and the congressman would contact her and find out more about this. And then Tom was saying that people should certainly write to the FCC as well. Ladies and gentlemen, if we aren't involved, believe me, the people on the other side are involved. And if we do not make a stand, the other side will, and we will lose by default. Then what else are you going to suggest, Tom?
If you will go to the website, www.savechristianradio.com, that's all one word, it actually has the address of the FCC, their fax number, and from that website you can actually make comments, which right now, because it's after April 14th, will not become part of the docket, but still they have to be read. So please go to that website. And again, if the FCC hears from enough people and know that I'm contacting my congressman and my senator about this, they may well take a second look and say, well, we better back off on this. At least that's my hope.
And because the thing is, this is going to impact on conservative radio stations, on Christian radio stations, on liberal radio stations. No one will be exempt from these rules and regulations.
Absolutely not.
Well, we're out of time, Tom. Thank you so very much. And anything you'd like to say before we let you go?
Well, just that I think this is a First Amendment matter. And while this has been primarily directed toward radio, it is very clear in these 200 pages of this notice of proposed rulemaking that if they get away with it in radio, television is next.
All right. Well, of course, it seems that government never has enough power, and I think what we need to do is let them know that we do not want them expanding their power. We may not like what some radio stations on the left do, but that's all right. We have to have freedom for freedom of expression. And it is not up to the bureaucrats to say what can be said and what cannot be said on radio stations, because when that occurs, of course, all freedom for the left, for the right, it will be lost forever. God bless. Thanks very much, Tom.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, that was Tom Reed, and I certainly hope that you enjoyed the conversation and that you will heed his suggestion that you write to your congressman. This is something that you can do positively. And believe me, of course, I believe that the last means we have of reaching people across America is talk radio, and I want you to know we're reaching people all across America through the networks we put together. Through the 5 hours of talk radio we do every day. I would hate to see this all destroyed by a new regulation from Washington, D.C., and believe me, there is no problem facing America today that more government interference will make worse. So understand that liberty and limited government are synonymous, and tyranny and total government are synonymous, and what you're seeing is a move, in my estimation, towards total government. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty, my ministry, is primarily listener-supported, and we depend upon those of you out there across America who listen to our programs, who agree with us, who are involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And if you would like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, get our monthly newsletter, and incidentally we will be sending this out by email. If you'd like to get it by email rather than a regular mail, it would help us. But not only that, it would give you the opportunity to send it to your friends simply with a click of the mouse there. And the more people you can get our newsletter to, the more people are beginning to understand what's going on. But when you join the Radio Liberty family, you get our tape of the month, four best tapes or CDs of the month. You get our monthly newsletter. But more than that, you're helping us maintain our network on shortwave, internet, satellite, and radio stations across America with almost 60 outlets every single week, where people are beginning to understand what's going on. We just need to be able to continue going, and we need to have the government not interfere with our effectiveness to reach people with the truth. And that, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our ministry, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Roy Upton. And this is an issue that is primarily local in the region where I live here in Monterey Bay, but the principles certainly can be extended all across the country, because here in the Monterey Bay area, the government has decided that they're going to spray the population because of the danger of the light brown apple moth, which apparently has come to the United States from New Zealand. And, of course, government officials in the state's capital insist this is going to destroy our agricultural market here, and of course other areas are not going to accept our produce. We have a lot of vegetables, lettuce, things like that produced in this region, and they're saying that, of course, the light brown apple moth is going to badly damage our agriculture production, but it hasn't done that yet, and they have no intention of spraying the area where the agricultural products are produced. They want to spray the people here in our area. And the question is, can we trust them? Then the spraying is harmless. They insist it is. They refuse, of course, to give us any details of many of the things that are in the product. But certainly they've sprayed one time already. And, of course, now they're going to be spraying again. And, of course, their statement is, why, this is ridiculous. We would never do anything to harm you. But I would like to point out that many government policies do harm the people. And if you have never read what we call the Rockefeller Committee report, came out of the Veterans Administration in 1994, talking about all of the macabre experiments they've done on the American people without their knowledge or consent. And really, most Americans have no idea how we've been used as guinea pigs over and over again. Well, certainly there are people in our local community who are very concerned about the spraying. The people don't want it. Well, the state says they're going to do it, whether we like it or not. You have no rights. We're in charge here. And, well, we'll talk to you, but it doesn't matter what you say. We're going to spray you. Well, there's a gentleman with us tonight, Roy Upton. And Roy Upton went over to New Zealand, along with one of his compatriots, to find out how dangerous is the light brown apple moth. They've had it in New Zealand for a long period of time. And Roy, why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself and why you are leading this battle to try to bring out the truth that you're not getting from the government, you're certainly not getting from state officials.
Well, a couple of things. Well, first, thanks for having me on. It's more we can get the story out, the more the people can be informed about it and hopefully bring an end to it. My interest in it came on actually all of a sudden. The spray wasn't even in my consciousness when it first happened. About 3 weeks before it happened, I was hiking down at Elkhorn Slough, which is a bird sanctuary right south of Santa Cruz there. And just about 30 yards off the road, I was flabbergasted at literally seeing 30 dead cormorants all just lying on the side of the bank. And the odd thing that about this was, one, there was such a high concentration of dead birds in one place, but also they were in pristine shape. They weren't eaten by maggots. They weren't tattered. They just simply looked like they dropped dead. And you never see that.
And isn't that an endangered species?
They're not an endangered species, but they are a protected species within the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary.
All right.
They're the birds that kind of swim underwater. They're the oldest birds on the face of the earth, actually. But it got me thinking, what could have possibly killed these birds?
Now, had they done the spraying yet at this time?
That was about 2 weeks after the last Monterey spray.
No, because they said that, of course, there's no evidence that nobody had been hurt, no danger to wildlife. You can trust us. We're from the government. There is no harm that's been done now. I've never heard about these dead birds. And so what happened at that time then? You saw the dead birds, And you said, how did this come about?
Yeah, and then we got sprayed here on a Thursday night, the month later. And the next day I had symptoms of scratchy eyes, scratchy throat, and I was thinking to myself, gee, I wonder if it was that spray stuff that did this. Because I'm not really that paranoid about pesticides. I don't like them. I buy organic, but at the same time, I know they're part of our life and never the twain shall meet. But so I had these scratchy eye and throat symptoms, and I read in some Monterey papers that those were the same symptoms that were being expressed by people that were sprayed in Monterey. So I said, oh, probably was the spray. But the day after, the Santa Cruz Sentinel started to report on hundreds of dead seabirds found along the coast. And I said, son of a gun, it is. There's a connection between that spray and this spray and the die-off of the birds. And then I started looking in at the toxicological profile of the ingredients within the Checkmate solution that was sprayed on us and the microcapsules and looking at all the safety data that I possibly could. And virtually all of the ingredients had some level of toxicological profile that was consistent with the symptoms that were seen by humans, expressed by humans, and also are known aquatic toxins to birds, to mollusks, to sea life. So I made the connection between the spray and this incredible environmental kind of hazard from the spray, and that's what got me involved in this.
Well, then, of course, you know, you sort of wonder that you talked about the birds that you've seen initially, and they weren't being certainly eaten by the maggots. They weren't being eaten certainly by the insects that you would ordinarily expect it. I wonder if maybe the insects were too smart to want to eat those birds and destroy them.
It wasn't that they were poisoned. What we found out after the fact is that the birds died of drowning because something likely in the spray either did two things. It either caused the stripping off of the oil of the birds so that they couldn't maintain their buoyancy and couldn't protect themselves from the cold water, or something that they systemically absorbed prevented them from producing oil. And then again, that caused the drowning.
But if they drowned, why didn't they drown in the water? Why were they up in the bank?
Probably just washed up.
All right.
Yeah, likely just washed up. And it was interesting in that we didn't see die-off of land birds, or a lot of land birds. There were a lot of people that reported that songbirds didn't show up again for a week and a half or 2 weeks after the spray.
Well, that hawk will be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Roy is simply pointing out that they found out why the birds had died. These are the ones, of course, that swim in the water so much. And apparently they drowned. Something had happened that had altered their ability to swim, or the oil in their feathers. But, of course, these birds apparently had just been washed ashore. But you don't see this sort of thing ordinarily. And then after they sprayed the north part of the county where we live in, why, there were all sorts of dead birds as well. And, of course, if it's killing the birds, what's it doing to the bees? What's it doing to the other insects? What's it doing, of course, to the fish and the other creatures that live here in the Monterey Bay Sanctuary? And has there ever been an environmental analysis, certainly of the impact of this on the butterflies? We have a large number of monarch butterflies. They say that they're not going to spray in that area. Well, if they're so worried about the butterflies, then, of course, why aren't they worried about all the other part of our flora and fauna?
Yeah, they did not do an environmental impact review, and this is the basis of the Monterey and the Santa Cruz County and City lawsuits against the state.
Well, because they say we've got to move fast before it destroys the agricultural
economy,
but then, of course, they're going to spray the people and not the agricultural areas. Why do they want to spray the areas where the people are rather than the areas where the agricultural is?
Predominantly because that's the only place they've found the moth is in residential areas. They haven't found it in the farms.
So
the reason
not
they probably
the
haven't found it in the farms is because the people doing the farming already have control measures in place that completely control the light brown apple moth. They likely don't have to do anything, and this light brown apple moth will be completely controlled within the agricultural community. They just don't believe that, but that's the typical experience of of agricultural experts, or the opinion of agricultural experts in New Zealand.
All right, why don't you tell us what you found? Because you went to New Zealand. Now, who paid your way over?
Actually, I didn't go. No,
you didn't go.
No, the two folks that went was Professor Dan Harder, who's the director of the UCSC Arboretum, and Mr. Jeff Rosendale, who's a horticultural expert from Watsonville.
All right.
And they're the ones that went. And Jeff went. Jeff stimulated the trip because he had his nursery shut down. His nursery here in Soquel was the first nursery where the light brown apple moth was found in a nursery. And so he was shut down a number of times. But he started communicating with people in Australia, people in New Zealand, and they were saying that it wasn't that big of a problem, and they didn't know why people in California were making such a big deal of it. So he decided to take a trip to New Zealand to see what's really going on the ground with regards to integrated pest management practices. Dan Harder got interested in it because he has one of the biggest collections of New Zealand plants at the Arboretum that's under his care, and he was afraid that if there was some moth that he had to be concerned about, is he going to lose his collection of rare and exotic plants? So he joined Mr. Rosendale, and they went to New Zealand, and they went, 3,000 square miles through New Zealand, one, looking for LBAM as to how prevalent it was, but more importantly, meeting with horticultural experts there, people in the Department of Conservation, people in hort research, which is the equivalent of our, United States Department of Agriculture, and also people that were actually farming and people that were in the government agencies that their job was to take care of pests in agriculture. This is the funny part. One of the most common pieces of feedback they would get when they would say, how big of a problem is the light brown apple moth to you guys? They'd say, the light brown what? LBAM, the light brown apple moth. I'm not sure what you're talking about. The superficial leaf roller that kills everything. No, it's not a big problem here. We don't do a lot with it. And they got this time and time again, not just once or twice, but a bunch of times. And they even went to the forestry people and said, hey, we've been told that by the California Department of Agriculture that this moth, this light brown apple moth, is going to destroy our redwoods, destroy our cypresses. What kind of damage do you see from this LBAM? And they say, L what? LBAM, light brown apple moth. I'm sorry, I don't know about that. Let me call somebody. Maybe I can find somebody who knows about it. So it was so little of a problem that many people, both in the farms as well as in the Department of Conservation, didn't even know about it. Now, the people that had been around for a long time, they knew about it because LBAM at one time was a problem. But that was when organophosphates were used, and the pesticides were killing all the beneficial predators. And so there was nothing to keep the LBAM in check, and they just multiplied because they very quickly became resistant to the pesticides, while the other predators died. So they just bloomed out, and they were more of a problem. But once they stopped using organophosphates, then the beneficial predators came back, and LBAM was no longer a big problem. And that's what the status is right now today in New Zealand.
Well, of course, now the local officials here in the state of California, their wisdom have rejected, of course, what Mr. Harder and Jeff had said. They say, well, that isn't true, It is because their plants over there have a resistance to the moth, whereas ours have no resistance to the moth. They're all going to be destroyed. The redwoods are going to be destroyed. The cypress are going to be destroyed. Our crops are going to be destroyed. Is there any evidence that any of this is true?
No, none whatsoever. I've looked at as much of the published scientific literature that I could find from 1979 or 1978 till the current date, all published on the light brown apple moth, its ability to be injurious to plants, its ability to go after native plants like in just, natural plants versus agricultural plants. And it's extremely exaggerated. The ability from the light brown apple moth to cause any amount of damage whatsoever to any individual crop is extremely small. And this is actually reflected in the CDFA and the USDA's assessment of LBAM. When you look at the numbers, that they extrapolate out to say, oh, the light-bound apple moth is going to destroy $600 million worth of crops or something like that. They base that number not on loss of dollars because of crop damage. They base it on loss of dollars because of the quarantine requirements that other countries have to meet, like New Zealand and Australia, if they want to export into the United States. So 99% of the costs associated with LBAM are due to meeting quarantine restrictions, not to protecting plants.
But of course, if the agricultural areas, if the agricultural farmers are actually using things that will kill the moth, it wouldn't be in the products we were shipping out, would it?
That's true. Most all of the pests, like mealybugs and aphids, that agricultural people treat for already, they're using other pesticides, will also control LBAM. And that's also shown in New Zealand. It's shown in Australia. And they also do other things. They use techniques such as intercropping, where plant every couple of rows with understory plants that draw beneficial predators into the agricultural area, and those protect against LBAM. And they very seldom have to treat for LBAM itself.
All right, so this is really not a factor. So basically, why do you think the state officials are so intent upon ignoring the wishes of the people and, of course, going ahead and treating? Certainly, they're talking about all sorts of things. They want to bring in wasps. They want to release a million wasps per square mile or something. Of course, these are supposed to be wasps that are not stinging, but how do we know? What are they going to do to our eco-environment as they begin bringing in other predators with the idea that somehow they are going to affect the LBAM? And then, of course, we hear the other things that they want to bring in. They want to use these sprays that are going to confuse the male moth so that they won't mate with the female moth. But what does that do to other things? What does that do to bees? What does it do to the other insects we have here?
Well, here's the thing that I'm most concerned about is the bees. If you look at the potential for damage to LBAM, they say that the worst case scenario is $600 million worth of damage. That's the worst case scenario if LBAM goes unchecked. And of course, it won't go unchecked. There's no pest that goes unchecked. Everything has checks and balances within nature if you have a healthy system. But the bees are particularly sensitive, and the reason why is not necessarily because of the pheromone itself, but because of the microcapsule delivery system that's used in the spray. The microcapsules, they're little tiny plastic beads that are filled with the Checkmate solution, which includes extremely toxic stuff to aquatic wildlife as well as bees. And what the micron size of the microcapsules is the exact same size as pollen grains. And there's two things that happen, or that seemingly happen with this microcapsule. One is that microcapsules are inherently designed to be sticky. So they come down, they get onto the plants, the bees go and forage on the plants, and they get this sticky stuff all over their body and their wings, and it makes it difficult to fly. In some cases, makes it impossible for them to fly. This was observed after the first Santa Cruz spray. I don't know if it was observed down in Monterey. But in Santa Cruz, the first night that I got up in public and told my story about the dead birds, the next day I got two calls from people who said, "Has anybody told you anything about the bees?" And they both reported dead bees and disoriented bees on the ground the day after the spray.
And, of course, the government officials say, that's not true, we've evaluated it, it's just not true, you can trust us because we're from the government, it's not true. Where's the proof?
They don't have any. They haven't done any environmental impact review whatsoever. And they've made mention that they say that it's not going to affect the bees, but they haven't made any comment whatsoever of the fact that the microcapsule size is the exact size of pollen. And the other part of it is that because it's the same size as pollen, the bees carry it back to the hive. And then those capsules break down over a period of 30 to 90 days, releasing their toxic ingredients to the hive.
Hold up. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, Sidney, you know, if they're going to, of course, hurt the bees, this is going to have a tremendous impact on some of our agriculture. How much of our agriculture really requires pollination? Do you have any idea?
About $35 billion.
Well, of course, that's for the country, but what about the things that we
grow
in this area?
Oh, that's in California. California is the biggest pollinator in the country, actually in the world, literally in the world. The business of pollination, just pollination itself, is a $14 billion industry. And it also supports another $15 billion industry of dairy, because dairy requires all of the things that bees pollinate in order to sustain the dairy industry. And then we're talking about things like almonds, which if they're not pollinated, you have tremendously decreased yields if almond trees aren't pollinated. So the pollination is not just, and we're not talking just about honey or beeswax or candles or, you know, things like that. These are just other costs that are associated with pollination in the state of California. It's a huge industry. And that was my original point, is that if they were to even have a marginal detrimental effect on the bees, this has the potential of causing greater agricultural damage than the light brown apple moth ever dreamed of causing. And we're already seeing nationwide what's called colony collapse syndrome, where bees are literally dying like flies, not figuratively, literally. Whole colonies and hives and ecosystems are being destroyed. And pesticides are considered one of the top four reasons why that probably is. There's a lot of different reasons as to why the colony collapse may be happening, but pesticides is one of the major reasons that's attributed to that syndrome. And the microcapsule delivery systems, of all the delivery systems for pesticides, are considered to be the single worst, have the single greatest impact, negative impact on bee colonies of any delivery system.
Well, of course, now, then, certainly we know that the different pesticides are being used there in certainly of our major crops. And, of course, basically, do they use these same little microcapsules?
Not that I know of. Mostly they're just routinely sprayed from planes. The microcapsule seems to be a unique delivery system for this pheromone. However, you asked a basic question before as to why the government is kind of digging their heels into this. And there's two things that I see that's kind of on the front of this. The first is that the pheromones represent this new age of pest management, where they're not using the quote-unquote toxic organophosphates like malathion or organochlorides or things like that, but that they can use these more relatively benign pheromone-type products. What they don't talk about is that they're filled with these inert ingredients that are also have a high level of toxicity, even if they're delivered at a low concentration. So this represents this whole new era, and a whole new industry has built up around this pheromone-type approach to dealing with pests. Well, and they believe they can go ahead and spray residential areas and get away with it under this guise of being safe. So this is a whole new era of pesticide pest management.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Roy Upton. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're talking to Roy Upton, and Roy, of course, is out there on the front lines trying to let people understand that this spraying that they want to do of the general population, it is the general population, they keep telling us they have to do this to protect the agricultural areas, but they're not spraying the agricultural areas, they're spraying the areas where the people live. Now, do we really know all of the contents of this pheromone? I understood it was part of this was secret, that they could not be released. It was proprietary secret. What do we really know that's in it?
What we know is, what we think we know, are all the ingredients in the Checkmate solution itself. Some people will question whether or not there was 100% disclosure on that formula, but I tend to believe that we did have 100% disclosure on the Checkmate solution itself. Now, what we don't know is whether or not there's anything added into the tanks at the time when they dump those into the plains. Because if you do any kind of ground spraying, you always have to, when you have those things on your back and people walking around with the hoses, you know, spraying along the sides of the road, you take the solution and you add it to the tank, and then you mix it with a diluent, something to dilute it, either water or surfactant or an emulsifier or something that'll make for a steady flow through the nozzles, for example. We don't know if any of that's being added to the planes, you know, as they fill them up. That's something that's yet unknown.
All right, fine. But you think that they've been honest with us. But why should we expect to be honest with us, telling us the ingredients, when so often government agencies in the past have simply lied to the American people, whether it be, MTBE. Oh, my goodness, MTBE is going to be wonderful. It's going to clean up the air. And of course, this is why we're going to mandate this be added to gasoline. Well, first of all, it was carcinogenic, and they knew it was a carcinogen. And then it began not only not to clear up the air, it began to pollute the water, and of course it cost literally hundreds of millions of dollars in lawsuits.
Yeah.
The government had simply lied to us. There was absolutely no scientific evidence to show that MTBE worked. If they lied to us about that, how do we know that they're really not lying about the contents of this checkmate? Do we really know what's there? Has anybody had an opportunity to have it analyzed independent of the government?
No, we tried to do it. We actually tried to access some checkmate, but by the time that we got around to wanting to test for stuff, it was already off the shelves. You know, the state of California had already purchased all of it. And we also wanted to test the water. Like, right after the spray, we had this terrible, terrible runoff of this, basically a pesticide soup that went into the Monterey Bay, and was a mile and a half long along the West Cliff Beach, right here in Santa Cruz.
And what about the effect on the animals and the sea life and certainly the fish?
Some people down in Monterey reported on otter die-off, but the Monterey Bay Sanctuary didn't report any otter die-off. And, of course, we had the bird die-off here, and many of the birds were physically covered with this yellow, sticky stuff. Which is the same stuff that was floating on top of the water in the bay. So we were able to get samples of that. I actually still have a jar of it in my refrigerator. But I work with labs literally all over the world, analytic labs that are specialists in water purification and water treatments and water testing. And nobody had a methodology that they could use to test for the ingredients that were in Checkmate. They could have developed it, but it would have cost about $3,000 to $5,000 per test, and then after that it'd be several hundred dollars per additional sample. We simply didn't have the funds to pay for the development of those methods, which we didn't even know would work at the end of the day. So we weren't able to independently test any of the solutions used, and I don't believe that anybody else did either. I do know that people at the Department of Fish and Game were physically collecting those samples, but they never, to this day, have written any report with regards to what they found of the contaminated water. And more importantly, the newspapers routinely report that as being foam that was created from red tide, and it's a complete lie or fallacy, because people actually witnessed this stuff coming through the drain, the runoff pipes into the bay. It's not something that emerged from the bay. It ran into the bay off of the land.
Well, now, why would the newspapers then say it was, of course, the red tide, when, of course, it should be so obvious that it was a direct result of this spraying effort that the people oppose, and yet the bureaucrats insist that they're going to do it whether we want it or not?
That's true. I mean, that is their mantra. I don't know if you saw the Santa Cruz Sentinel today, but they literally, the CDFA specifically warned Santa Cruz City and Santa Cruz County that if they don't accept the pheromones, that we will be sprayed with more toxic pesticides.
Hold that thought. We'll be back. Hold that. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, This is Dr. Stan. Our guest here is Roy Upton, and of course Roy is simply saying that they have threatened and threatened our elected representatives that if we don't go along with their program to spread this pheromone, for which there is absolutely no scientific studies that we have seen, or no environmental impact studies, they're saying, well, we'll spray with something more toxic. Isn't that sort of this bully tactics that are used by authoritarian groups? If you don't go along with us, we're really going to make your life miserable.
Absolutely, and they did this to the farmers as well. There was a meeting with a group of farmers last week, and the farmers asked, "Well, what will your next phase be if you can't eradicate the light brown apple moth?" And they said simply, then we're going to quarantine every bit of produce that exists in the state, and we're going to fumigate it before it's sent anywhere. That's what they said, to instill the fear of God in the farmers. And the same thing, basically, in the Sentinel today, is they're thumbing their nose up at the state legislature, our city governments, our county governments, basically threatening that if you don't accept this, we're going to come in with more toxic pesticides, and you're not going to like that even worse.
Well, now, of course, the thing is that certainly aren't these people supposed to be our servants? Aren't they public servants? Aren't they paid by the public?
Of course they are.
And, of course, what about Governor Schwarzenegger? What is he doing as far as this is concerned? Or is he going right along with this whole agenda?
Up to now, he's gone right along with the agenda, and it's hard to say what his actual personal opinion is. I think he's mostly deferred to the Department of Agriculture to say, hey, you guys, you deal with it. I trust you. The USDA said we have to do this. Go do it. And he's basically not publicly said anything. Now, my understanding is that they may elicit his response as early as next week. He may weigh in on it. There was some email communications that I saw where Governor Schwarzenegger was coming around to having to get himself involved in this process, which he hasn't done to date.
Well, now, because why is there this sense of urgency? This has been over in New Zealand for many, many years, and they live
more than 100 years.
More than 100 years. And how long has the light brown apple moth been here in our area? So the government keeps trying to tell us it's just arrived, but isn't there evidence it's been here for quite some time?
There's not a lot of evidence that it's been here a long time. But there are models that suggest that it's been here a long time. And mostly those models come from Professor Keary.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Roy Upton was telling us that the government officials are very autocratic. Certainly, they're threatening the farmers, saying, well, if we're not able to do what we want to do, we're going to just quarantine everything in this state, and everything is going to have to be fumigated before it leaves, and the inference is going to be the farmers are going to be hurt very badly financially, because if you don't want to go along with what the government officials want, they're going to make your life miserable. And how did the farmers feel about being threatened by the state officials?
I think it depends on the farmer. The smaller farmers who really care about their produce, they don't like it a bit, and there have been a number of farm bureaus who formally oppose at least the aerial portion, the residential spraying, with pesticides. And then there's others that more represent big agribusiness that they're in support of this. For example, the grape growers in Napa are generally supportive.
But they're not getting sprayed, are they?
They're not getting sprayed, interestingly enough, because they already have pest management practices that will control LBAM. So, no, that's the ironic thing. Whereas they'll stand there supporting it, but they don't need to be sprayed, and they don't have to have, for example, the city of Napa or St. Helena or Calistoga, which are incredibly rich tourist areas. They're not going to get doused with this stuff, whereas Monterey and Santa Cruz are. So they're protected. Their agriculture is protected, and their tourism is protected, where ours is not.
Well, is the light brown apple moth up there in the surrounding community?
Yes. Now, LBAM was found in Napa, and it was found in Sonoma. And here's the, again, going back to your basic question as far as how long LBM has been here, as you said, they don't just pop up. You don't get populations of anything just taking a ride on an apple coming from Hawaii or New Zealand. One moth does not a population make. And so for these different populations or these different pockets of LBAM to be found all the way from Sonoma down to Los Angeles, literally down to Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, you're talking 8,000 to 10,000 square miles. Those things did not just pop in and out in onesies or twosies. That means that those populations have been developing probably over decades. And likely, they have blended in with all of our native moths, because you can't even tell the difference between the light brown apple moth and some of the California native brown moths. For years, they said they might have been looking. Actually, they might have found light brown apple moth, but didn't recognize them. When they first started testing for light brown apple moth here, they very quickly realized we can't tell them apart. We have to go to genetic testing. Well, they were never doing genetic testing before, so they have no idea whether or not LBM was really here, and all indications, just because of the populations being spread over 10,000 square miles, suggest that it's been here for many decades.
Well, are they planning then on spraying Napa and Sonoma and those areas up there, if they have the moth there as well as in here? Or
that's
do they
the
want
potential.
To just, what's that?
That is the potential. But again, in Napa, because the grape people already have integrated pest management practices in place, they say, you're already doing things that'll control LBAM, therefore we don't need to aerially spray you.
Well, now, why can't we do those same things that the grape growers are doing here?
We can, and we can learn from the example of New Zealand. We can learn from... Actually, the CDFA has exempted about 40 different crops because they have integrated pest management programs that control for the moth. They're not, those farmers that have these control practices, they're not eradicating the moth, they're just controlling pests in general. And CDFA, in their wisdom, has said, therefore, we will not aerially spray you. But it's completely unfair, because we could do the same thing here, is control the moth. With pesticides if needed, but with integrated pest management practices, which are used in New Zealand, Australia, and in these other areas, and we could use them effectively in the agricultural setting where these things belong.
Well, I'd like to know, of course, who owns this specific pheromone? Is there any relationship between the people who have that and people in positions of government? Any financial arrangement? Is there a possibility that simply part of this is an effort to enrich the insecticide producers? They must be making a lot of money off of this. And how do we know, of course, that there are not other things they could use just as effectively? Why are they so wedded to this one approach?
Again, on the first part of the question, you obviously know the answer, that of course you got to follow the money, and there's always a money trail. And so the owner of the pesticide company Sutera, his name is Stuart Resnick, he also is the biggest citrus producer in the world, which means he's the biggest citrus producer in California, but that means he's the biggest citrus producer in the world. He also produces pomegranates and avocados and also owns Fiji Water, and there's a pomegranate juice product in the health food store. It's called Palms, and he owns all of these different products. And they're all linked to agricultural products. He was also one of the top 10 donors to the Schwarzenegger campaign. And
would that actually demonstrate a definite conflict of interest if he was a large contributor to the Schwarzenegger campaign? In fact, are people limited in the amount of money they can give the politicians, or do we really have the best politicians money could buy?
I think, again, you know the answer to that. That's what America is known for. We do have the best politicians money can buy. And I mean, I've been involved in Washington politics for about 15 years in different aspects, and there's about anywhere from 15 to 20% of the congressional representatives that are really there for the right reason. They're there because they want to serve. They're there because they want to better the communities and serve people. And then there's others that are just basically career politicians, and they're not necessarily out there to do what's right, but more they're out there to do what's expedient. We're lucky here in Santa Cruz. We've always had good representation. We've had Sam Farr. We've had Leon Panetta. We've had Norman Mineta. These were people that represented, in my eyes, among the highest quality of the politicians that we have in Washington. So we've always been lucky, and maybe that's a reflection of the community. They've always cared about the environment. They've cared about human rights. They're not necessarily just rubber stampers for government policy. They're willing to buck the trend. So we've been lucky, but right now, currently, there's not enough federal representation or opposition to this issue. It's all been dealt with in the state legislature versus the feds.
But, of course, if certainly the man who developed this pheromone has contributed large sums of money to Arnold Schwarzenegger, don't you think that the public should be made aware of that and they should begin to understand where Arnold's really coming from? Because, yeah, after all, if somebody gives you a lot of money, they don't give it to you because they like your physique or your smile.
Right. No, that's true. And actually, the CDFA was a little bit of, had a little bit of an embarrassing situation 3-4 weeks ago, because part of the, they got $75 million from USDA in order to implement this program. Well, they were taking $75 million. They were taking $500,000 and hiring a PR firm to tell us how good pesticides are for us and how bad we need this program because, like you said, the moth is going to destroy Manhattan. Well, what they found, an AP reporter in New York, interestingly enough, found that they got that contract without going out to a competitive bid. And there was somebody within the administration that didn't feel comfortable about awarding that bid, that contract, without a competitive bid, and made that known, and memos were released, and literally the day after that this news story broke, the CDFA pulled the contract from the PR firm, and you know their public statement was that we don't believe we've done anything wrong, there was nothing illegal, but we're discontinuing this contract. So, of course, you have to follow the money, and there's always the economic aspects that have to be looked at, but there's also entrenched mentality. The entrenched mentality is that that nature can't take care of itself, that we have to force nature to comply with our will. And what they've learned in New Zealand, probably more than any place else, is that if you promote a healthy ecosystem, if you promote a healthy population of beneficial predators, you will not have the pest problems that you're envisioning that you're going to have. This has already been demonstrated in the fields for many, many years, not just 1 or 2 years, but many years in practical experience. In 2005, New Zealand shipped 3,000 container loads of agricultural produce to the United States. Of the 3,000, only 7 of them were rejected because of light brown apple moth finds. And that doesn't mean that the thing was infested. They could have found a single larva, and they would have rejected the whole container because there's what's called a zero tolerance against LBAM in the U.S. But the fact that they had 3,000 containers and only 7 had any semblance of LBAM whatsoever shows that they have a remarkable control over LBAM, and they're not spraying their people right and left with this stuff.
Well, of course, we have any idea what the effect is on people. Now, of course, the government insists there's no problem there. The government says, you know, we hear all these stories about people with itching eyes and all the problems, but and the coughs and things like that, but we reject that. And, of course, then you have the government officials like the public health officer. Well, that's just not true. But they haven't looked into it. Have they really done studies? Have they talked to the people? You know, have they had done blood tests on them? Have they done any medical studies to be sure that there's absolutely no problem? And then what about the long-term problem? Certainly we know that Agent Orange over in Vietnam, you know, had a terrible deleterious effect, and they lied about that for 25 years before they finally admitted, yes, it could produce all sorts of cancers and certainly systemic disease. And now the veterans, 25, 30 years later, those who are still living could get compensation for the Agent Orange, but the government lied about dioxin. Certainly they're saying there's no danger from depleted uranium now. They say there is no Gulf War illness. They used our soldiers during the first Gulf War for medical experiments, and certainly anybody has to look at the Rockefeller Committee report came out of the Veterans Administration, totally suppressed, but of course they're pointing out that they experimented on our soldiers. If they experiment on the soldiers, would they experiment on us as well?
Yeah, some people definitely go off in that direction. I tend not to, though I acknowledge the potential for truth of it. I don't give these guys that much credit. I think they're predominantly economically driven bureaucrats that don't really think out of the box. There was a pest that was on a list, a 30-year-old list. It showed up here, and they went into attack mode. It's a very right-wing kind of neocon, you know, knee-jerk reaction to something that they should have taken a deep breath, looked at what was happening on the fields in New Zealand, in Australia, in the real world, not from one single academic mission's perspective in southern, you know, New Zealand, who was a primary consultant, to really look at what the whole country is doing with regards to this pest. And then they should have said, is this something that we can do here so we don't have to subject residential areas to widespread pesticide applications?
But can they actually guarantee that there is no harm to human beings or, of course, to our animal or fish life?
No, but they won't do that.
What?
They won't do that. Secretary Kawamura last week on a radio show here, you know, specifically said that. No, there is no way that we can absolutely guarantee that there'll be no detrimental effects.
Well, then why don't we simply start out spraying Sacramento? Why don't we take a few of those moths, plant them up there, and let's say you spray Sacramento, you spray your children, spray your families first, and then when we know that you really aren't worried about it, then, of course, we'll consider it.
Right, and a lot of people have said that. The first thing, again, Secretary Kawamura, as well as some of the public health officials, literally let themselves be exposed to this stuff. And we say, you know what, that's not good enough. Bring your children down here. You know, next time, we'll put you up in a hotel, and we'll walk you down to the boardwalk while that spray is going on. And you have your 8 and your 9 and your 13-year-old children alongside, or your nursing baby. Bring them down to enjoy the spray, and then talk to us about being exaggerating what our fears are, or dismissing our concerns. Because one of the things we didn't mention here tonight is that there was an 11-month-old baby that almost died in Monterey. The day after, literally, the morning after the spray, he started developing like symptoms of what seemed to be a cold or a flu. But for the next 2 days, it got progressively worse until on Friday, literally, his eyes were rolled back into his head. He was literally almost comatose and non-responsive, rushed to the emergency room, and almost died. And that kid, friends of ours had lunch with the father and the mother of this child 2 weeks ago. And from that moment, that child has had asthma and respiratory problems, which he had never had before. And there's at least 4 other children, 2 here and another one down in Monterey, all who expressed, the parents said, yeah, my child never had any kind of respiratory distress prior to the spray, and literally the morning after, now have asthma.
Have they been contacted by the local public health official who assures us that this couldn't have happened? Have any of these people been contacted by the government officials?
No, that's the real criminal part of this, is that the father of the 11-month-old down in Monterey, Jack Wilcox, he's a major in the Air Force, I believe, and he's outraged that nobody has ever contacted him. And just last week, the Department of Pesticide Regulation in OEHA, Office of Environmental Health Hazards, put out a report basically trying to discount the veracity of all the adverse effects that were made.
But that they don't investigate them, how can they simply say they're not significant?
That's right. That's our point, too. That's an impossible statement to make.
Well, of course, this is really what's so concerning to me, is the fact that this cavalier part on the part of the government, but then we've seen these cover-ups time and time and time again with other things, and of course they are bound and determined. Are they going to spray, or are they still going to release these stingerless wasps, the million wasps every square mile? Are they still up to that?
They are, and there's two things there. The first one you mentioned is, what will that concentration of wasps do to the monarch butterflies, to the native wasps that don't do anything? They're not harming anything. There's 300 closely related moths to this light brown apple moth.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment. Well, Roy, of course, said, do you have a website or anything that you'd like people to go to get more information?
I think the two best websites for information are stopthespray.org and lbam spray.org. Those are the two primary websites that will give anybody as much information as they possibly can use. This is going to be, the next few weeks are going to be extremely important. Tomorrow there's several pieces of legislation that are being heard in the state legislature, and unfortunately they're in front of the Agricultural Committee. The Agricultural Committee is not very supportive of the people that want to stop the spray. They're in support of big agribusiness. So that's probably how they're going to vote. But there's a number of people people that are going to be busing up to Sacramento tomorrow. And you can go on to the lbamspray.org website and get directions on how to get up there or who to contact in order to hook up with the buses.
That's lbamspray.org, www.lbam, L-B-A-M. That's a light brown apple moth.
Right.
lbamwebsite.org, lbamspray.org.
Yes.
Would you be available on the 3rd of May for another radio program? We actually would like to get you on to KSCO. I'll be doing the Saturday program. That would be available?
I'll have to check on my calendar, but we can talk. If you give me an email or call me office.
I'll call you, because I really want to get your information out as far and wide as we can. I mean, I think you're taking a very intelligent attitude towards this, you know, and certainly just sticking with the science. And the science says they don't know. They don't know, but they're determined to do it for whatever reason this may be. And, of course, suddenly the big agriculture seems to be in favor of it. But, of course, is there any way that their crops would be damaged by the spraying at all?
Unlikely, because these guys are used to spraying gnarly stuff, you know, harsher chemicals on their crops. So they're not really afraid of pheromone pesticide solutions like most of us are.
But has anybody else used this pheromone in large substances in any other crop?
No. This is the interesting part, is that pheromones are generally used only for monitoring. They're not really used as an eradication tool. They're predominantly used for monitoring and occasionally for population reduction because it helps to prevent mating. But it's never been used for an eradication tool.
Hold that thought right
there.
It's
never been sprayed over residential areas, ever.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ray is simply saying that this really is sort of an experiment. Pheromone has been used in the past for monitoring, but this is the first time it's ever been used as an eradication tool. It's never been sprayed over populated areas before. It sounds to me like they're experimenting with this. Do you have that feeling?
Oh, absolutely. And the saddest part about there is that, you know, in the public, in the press, on radios, in public forums, they say that all of the decisions they make are based on science.
But if they don't have any studies, how can they have any scientific studies?
That's the point. They have absolutely none. And we actually consider this to be a violation of the what's called the Plant Protection Act, which is the act that gives them the authority to quarantine.
Well, I want you to know I really appreciate so much your coming on with us. We're out of time, but thank you so much, and we'll be talking to you later. I appreciate the fact that you're willing to put your time and your effort into trying to bring the truth out, and I certainly am proud of the people of Santa Cruz and even our local government under these circumstances that they're willing to take a stand against us. God bless. Thanks very much.
You too. Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, that was Roy Upton, and I realize that many of you out there across America are going to say, well, this doesn't affect me, but the basic principles do affect you because there is a population control agenda. Those of you who have never seen my talk on Nundare College Genocide, my talk on planned population reduction, or my talk on population control, they're three separate talks that are available to Radio Liberty. Nundare College Genocide, planned population reduction, and population control. There really are people who plan to kill off the majority of the world's population, and they're already in the process of doing it with the AIDS epidemic, which we are not trying to stop using standard public health approaches by outlawing DDT. They've killed almost 50 million people since the ban on DDT was put in place 50 years ago. Actually, it's closer to 100 million people, but most of them have been in areas where they're predominantly black, and the elitists really aren't concerned about how many black people are killed, and certainly this is what Reverend Wright is saying, Jesse, by me, Barack Obama's minister, of course. I don't like Reverend Wright because he's a black racist, but that doesn't mean that everything he says is absolutely wrong. And unfortunately, there really are people who look upon black people as being inferior, and that is why they outlawed DDT and allowed almost 100 million people, almost 3 million a year, contrary to what you're told in the media. It's not 1 million people a year, but 3 million people a year die of malaria, predominantly children and predominantly black in Africa and in other underdeveloped countries. And if you want to check what I'm saying, certainly go up on the Internet and just Google in 3 million people die a year of malaria, and you'll get all sorts of hits on that. They're simply distorting the statistics here. They don't want you to know that there is a genocidal agenda. So we hope that you'll want to get our material. We have written something called the Population Control Agenda Monograph, where we simply quote from people like Jacques Cousteau, who talks about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. Eliminating 350,000 people a day. The article comes from the UNESCO Courier, November 1991. We'll be glad to send you copies of the pages of that, or go to our website and pull down my Population Control Agenda monograph. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Remember, of course, they've taken mercury out of the childhood vaccines. In this country, we're still giving them to the children in Africa. Why? Because they affect fertility not only in one generation, but in subsequent generations, as well as, of course, in many instances, they're destroying the minds of the children. But you don't need very smart people. You really don't care. This is for a much larger agenda. It's population control. If you do not believe that is the major thrust of American policy, you need to get National Security Study Memorandum 200. That's NSSM 200. It's available on the Internet, or you can get it bound from Radio Liberty. If you don't believe that they have plans for mass murder, why, you need to get the testimony by Dr. David MacArthur. They're all available from Radio Liberty. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for God's mercy on America for what we have done.